Kay and I drove down from our cabin where we spent most of the summer yesterday and had thousands of cars that looked like we're going north. So I figured, oh, there could be nobody here. But that's great. I'm glad to see you all. This morning is about the fourth or fifth annual Taking Stock. I call it Taking Stock Labor Day talk we have. And at the Zen Center, like at schools, Labor Day is the start of a new school season. And at the Zen Center, it's a whole new start of, a whole new set of classes and retreats and things like this. So I kind of talk about that a little bit. And I talk a little bit about just taking stock about where you are. And so this is kind of, it's not an informal talk, but we want to make it kind of relaxed. And so if you have questions and you want to interject or something like that, feel free to do. If Dan can put the clock where I can see it a little bit, with luck I will try to talk about 30 minutes and feel free to interrupt. And then I want to leave about 10 minutes or 15 minutes for people to actually add on about taking stock and some of their ideas. And some of the teachers are here, and we want to talk about some of that, etc. So basically, I'm going to talk about three different things, or at least put things in three different categories. And the first is really your individual practice. How many people feel that they're kind of new to the Zen Center or Buddhism? Many people? Okay, and don't hesitate. I'm not going to make you ask you to push a peanut across the floor with your nose or anything like that. But it helps me a little bit with establishing the tone of what I'm talking about, etc. So the first part is about establishing and working with your own practice. And then the second part is about actually extending that practice to other people. And you'll see in Buddhism, we have an ideal, at least our branch of Buddhism, called the Bodhisattva ideal. And it's the idea that one reason we practice is so that we can actually take that practice and help others around us. And that's one of the real rationales for our practice. And so we have to understand that, and I'll talk a little bit basically about that. And then the third thing I'm going to talk about is actually for people who have a more advanced practice. And I want to talk about a few trends in Western Buddhism that are occurring. And we know that as Buddhism entered China and Japan, Tibet, etc., it underwent a kind of a cultural absorption and reformulation. So I want to just say a little bit about that so that advanced people can figure, we have something to think about the next year as well, about how that's affecting us. Now, some people like one single thought you hold on to, right? And you talk about it the whole time, and it makes it easy. I've got a whole bunch of thoughts. And so if you hear these things go by, just figure, I better take stock. Okay, and that's what all of this basically is about. Well, I wanted to, as far as our individual practice, there's really 9 practices I wanted to mention. That you might want to think about and absorb into your practice. And again, this is particularly important for a person who's starting, not sure where to go. Buddhism is absolutely, particularly Zen, is absolutely famous for no instructions because there's no place to go and no way to get there anyway. Okay, so if you've done a little reading, you have some idea of what I'm talking about. So I'm going to give you 9 kind of ideas, something to think about. And, of course, I don't have my glasses, and I'm sure not what the 9 is, so if it comes out to be 7 or 6, that's the way it's going to be. But the first is to really establish a meditation practice. And this summer I taught a course, and Judy was part of it.
Guy, you want my readers?
Yeah, very much so. This could change the whole talk. Fantastic. I had a course called Cultivating Attention that Judy was part of. And if you're starting meditation, you say, why meditate? Why meditate? And why have been people meditating in the Buddhist tradition for 2,500 years? And being Westerners, of course, we want to say, why? Why should we do this? And this is peculiar for Westerners. We always want an explanation, etc. So we had a course this summer called Cultivating Attention, where we read a book by Dan Siegel called The Mindful Brain. Do I remember it right? The Mindful Brain, where we find that even 10 minutes a day, basically, it changes the architecture of your brain. Even 10 minutes a day. And for me, this is really important because people think, well, meditation is just some kind of subsidiary practice. It's something Buddhists do because they don't want to go out and run around the lake or something like that to get fit. But to get fit in a Buddhist way, you have to meditate and you have to learn. Siegel refers to attuning the brain. You're literally changing the architecture of the brain. You're connecting things in the prefrontal area. And one of my great questions for years as a practicing Buddhist was, where does compassion come from? Where does compassion come from? Because if you actually look at the practice and equanimity, there should be no compassion. You know what I mean? There should be no hate. There should be no like. There should just be present, right? So where does compassion come from? And when you read Buddhism, they talk about compassion is one of the great outcomes of this kind of practice. And you find when you read Siegel, and there are a dozen other books like that now, that basically a part of our evolution, I'm an anthropologist, by the way, part of our evolution as primates, etc., is social training. And we're social animals. And you find that as the architecture of the brain becomes rearranged and attuned, etc., basically that what it's doing is it's stimulating these social circuits in the brain. And thus we have loving kindness and compassion and things like this. And so again, my very first thing is a meditation practice. And again, 30 minutes is great, but if you only have 10 minutes, great. If you find it's difficult to sit, etc., there are all kinds of other kind of meditations that your teachers will talk about. So the very first thing is a meditation practice. Just a few more about that. When you meditate, and I don't know how you meditate, but thoughts come up, right? And you can't get rid of thoughts. And part of learning to be a mature meditator is just to see those thoughts come up and they go off like that. You know, they just come up like bubbles or clouds and away they go, etc. And what you do as a meditator is you learn to watch and you learn to observe and you learn to be the witness, if you will, of things that arise. It may be a pain in the knee. It may be thoughts that come in your mind. And Dogen, who is the great head of our lineage out of Japan, a 13th century Buddhist, etc., talks about in his great moment of enlightenment, etc., what happened was his body and his mind fell away. His body and his mind fell away. And what's he talking about? He's talking about that once you observe, you're not your body. You can feel the aches and pains. Once you observe, your thoughts come up and you're not your thoughts. You're not your thoughts. Body and mind drop away, etc. So you have a meditation practice, etc. We know from neuroscience, etc., that you've got to do it. Ken Wilber, some of you read, etc., always says you've got to do the yoga. And what he means by that, you've got to do the practice. If you don't do the practice, then it doesn't happen. That's the first one, meditation. A second one, is a mantra. And in our practice of Zen, we don't work with mantras very much. I ran across a nice story I just loved about why elephants carry little bamboo poles in their trunk when they walk through an Indian village during a ceremony. And the reason is that if they're not holding on to something, that trunk reaches out and grabs everything that passes by. It goes by a market, there goes a coconut, there goes some bananas, things like this, etc. So it keeps the elephant occupied, that thing. A mantra is our bamboo pole, or it can be for people whose mind really wanders. And there are wonderful mantras that we can use in Buddhism. And I think of the one at the end of the Heart Sutra, Gate, Gate, Par, Gate, Par, Samgate, Bodhisattva. And I better read it to make sure I get it right. It says, gone, gone, altogether gone, altogether gone to the other side, enlightenment, cool. Okay, cool. And one way to actually keep that elephant trunk of a mind from overly wandering is to use the mantra. And it's something that's not regular part of our practice, but something I recommend. A third practice is learning to slow down. And this is something we can all do. Just learn to slow down, be patient, learn to slow down, practice every day, etc. Be present. And I won't say more about that, but we rush. And I find myself rushing myself. And so I always remind myself, be patient. Slow down. If you don't slow down and you're not patient, you're not present. Okay, you're not present in every moment. You're not present in every moment. Okay? So be patient. It's just something. It's an easy thing, etc. And people have all these tattoos today wherever I go, and I still want to see a tattoo saying, be patient. Be patient. You know, something like that. So slow down. A fourth practice is one pointed attention. The course we had this summer was called Cultivating Attention. And what we're trying to do in meditation, you know, is just not a mantra, just not watching our breath, you know, things that you're familiar with, etc. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to focus our attention. It can be on the breath. It can be on a mantra. If we're really advanced practitioners in Zen, we do shikantaza, which means you concentrate on nothing, but your attention is just pure attention, pure being there. And this is what really attunes the mind, is this one focus, the unity, etc., of the lack of multitasking. So when you wash the dishes, you wash the dishes. When you drive the car, you don't listen to the radio, drive the car. Okay? So cultivate attention. And there are wonderful books called Cultivating Attention or Reed Siegel, etc. But again, you know, the key to really this attunement we're talking about, etc., is to learn to cultivate and hold attention. Usually when you meditate, they talk about two kinds of meditation. And the first is just watching the breath. And you're cultivating attention, etc. You're doing zazen, etc. And then the second kind of meditation is an awareness meditation. An awareness meditation, where you're consciously aware of what arises. Whether it's the thoughts, it might be something like this, etc. So I worry about cultivating attention, and we can talk about all of these things sometimes if you're interested. A fifth a kind of practice, and again, you're probably wondering what the first four were. But the fifth is training your senses. Just like you have to train your mind, your senses have to be trained as well. And our senses, if you give it some thought, are like puppy dogs. They're all over the place, getting in trouble, they're eating things they shouldn't eat, etc. Does that sound familiar? We eat things we shouldn't eat, we ingest things we probably shouldn't, etc. All kinds, etc. And I'm not just talking about what goes into our mouth, I'm talking what goes into our eyes, what goes into our ears. How do we watch TV? What do we listen to? What kind of conversations do we engage in with others who are talking negatively and things like this? And so we have all kinds of senses. We usually think of the five senses, the five bodily senses. But we also have a sixth and seventh and eighth sense, according to Siegel. And the sixth, for example, is just a mind sight. And that is being able to attune to be filled with somebody else's mind. And that's a sense. You can feel happiness. You can feel sadness. All of this. That's a sense, etc. And it's something that you cultivate and you really work on, if you will. And then we also have a sense of our general internal feeling. How do we feel? Our body, etc. Sadness, achy, whatever. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter, and these days they're raising kids kind of different. They're trying to make them more sensitive to their feelings. And so, 2 years old. I talked to her on the phone 2 days ago when I was up at the cabin. I says, "How are you feeling?" And she says, "Me cranky." 2 years old. Me cranky. so anyway, You train the mind. You train the senses. And when you think of the senses, think of the eight senses, etc. Not just, what goes in the mind, what goes in the ear, what goes in the eye. You know what I mean? But think of the way you relate through mind sight, if you will, the way you relate with other people, things like this. Six is putting others first. When you practice a lot of Buddhism, etc., that one thing you learn, that famously say that there is no self, that we're part of a greater unity. And I won't go into that, we don't have time to go into it in depth, etc., but once you realize that there's a greater unity, that you're just part of a greater whole, etc., then you start treating people like yourself. You know what I mean? You work within a unity. We're all one, if you will, even if it's a person you don't like. You know what I mean? You don't like. And I've been gifted in my work by having a few people who, who really test test my compassion and loving kindness, etc. But again, so think about, and these are just simple things to think about, things we've talked about. For example, developing a simple meditation practice. Working with a mantra. If you find your mind is just overly active, work with a mantra. It's very useful. There are lots of them. Slow down. Work on one point of attention. Train your senses. Put other people first. A seventh practice is to work in a spiritual community. In Buddhism, we have something called the Sangha. The Sangha, and that's the group of us who practice together. Okay, and a lot of people, the majority of people I find, work better being part of a spiritual community. If you don't like a bigger community like the Zen Center, you can get a group of friends that you sit with, But it really helps to have people who support your practice, etc. And there's usually somebody who's doing. And this doesn't sound quite Zen-like, but doing better than you are. And so it's really nice to be around people like that. So think of the Sangha, if you will. And then the eighth practice, which I find very, very helpful, is to read the mystics. Read the mystics. And I use that general term. Read the mystics, etc. Really read the stories of people who've moved beyond, who've gone taken the raft across the river, who've experienced whatever we call enlightenment, so that you get the taste of it. You feel the taste of it. What's it like? How do they think different? How do they act different, etc.? And there are just, lots and lots of things. And you don't restrict yourself just to Buddhism, but in Buddhism, for example, we have the Buddha's Dhammapada, for example, which I have here. Dogen Shobogenzo, and the names aren't particularly important, but Teresa of Avila's The Way of Perfection, for example. There are just many, many, many. And I find at night, before I go to bed, I pick up one of these books, one of these stories, etc. Krishnamurti is another, etc. Just wonderful. And just read a little bit. You don't have to read a lot. But just get a feel for how they thought, the serenity of thought, the unity of being one with all, etc., the compassion, the loving kindness, etc. I find that very useful. And it doesn't have to be Buddhism, as I say. Every religious tradition has great people who are great. And then my ninth one, this is just for our own practice, etc., development, is work with a teacher. We're fortunate here at the Zen Center to have wonderful teachers. There are various ways that you can work with a teacher in your practice. If you're a member, you can meet with our abbot, Tim Burkett, and talk about your practice. But we also have many other teachers here, and there are some of them here, and we also have some on deck. It's in November when we go through ordination, etc. A lot of times it's very easy to get waylaid, to think you're making progress, etc. And a lot of times working with a teacher is really useful. I mentioned Ken Wilber earlier. Ken Wilbert talks about something called Buddhist boomeritis. He talks that way. And he says, one of the problems when you meditate and you're just with what arises, etc., is that ego can arise. And you're just with it. And you don't necessarily reflect on it, etc. He says you have to learn to actually step out of your practice and look at your practice to see where you are and what you're thinking, etc. And in most cases, I've found that a person who's been there ahead of me and has made these accomplishments can look at me and shake his head and say, "Guy, no chance." Not really, but I do encourage you to take advantage. We have a sign up on the board if you want to meet with one of the teachers or if you're a member of Ken Burkett. And we'll talk a little bit more later in the question and answer period about what you do with a teacher. How do you work with a teacher? Well, let me talk. That's the first part, and that's developing your practice. And you probably can't remember them all, but if you want to talk about it, I'm happy to do that. The second part is actually reaching out to others. And this is a bodhisattva ideal. Remember, the bodhisattva ideal, we practice, we reach out. We give ourselves to others in various ways. I'll just mention two ways to do this. And you have to form bridges to do this. You don't just do it. You do this with part of your practice, etc. And let me see if I can find it. The first is what we call the four immeasurables. And this is the practice of loving kindness, compassion, joy or empathetic joy, and equanimity. And when we talk about loving kindness, you're sending out loving kindness to others, etc. And there are all kinds of ways, but here's just this is Karen Salzberg's book called The Force of Kindness. I want to mention later a little bit. But she says, and so what you do is you have a little set of sayings like, may my best friend live in safety. May my best friend have mental happiness or peace and joy. May my best friend have physical happiness. May my best friend live in ease. And you can do this with loving kindness, and you do this with compassion. And the way it basically works is that you start with a person that you truly like and admire. And so you can get that feeling because you like this person. You can just feel this compassion and loving kindness come up in your body for that person. And then you can think of a person who's, kind of a friend, but not a, great friend, but still a friend. You always throw yourself in there. You say, may I have peace, etc. And then you think about a person who basically is someone you have interaction with, but no real feeling, like the person who makes your coffee at the coffee house. You know what I mean? And then you think of a person that you don't like. And then if you have people you really dislike, you work with that. And the idea is that you just work through these. And what you're doing is you're learning to actually turn outwards. You're learning to work with this unity. And your loving kindness is just loving kindness without any expectation of reward. You just want these people, to have a great life. Compassion is sending out something for a person in suffering, a person who has some suffering, whether it's mental suffering or physical suffering, etc. And joy is just, joy for the success of others. You're just so happy without any sense of, I want return. Okay. And then equanimity is a practice where you learn what do you do with real joy and real sadness? You know what I mean? And how do you just work in between? Real joy is often a trap as much as real suffering. You know what I mean? And so that's the four immeasurables. And then the second practice for reaching out and one that I'm really attuned to myself is the gift of listening. And there's no greater gift you can give to other people than to listen. Many of us are familiar with, you're at the coffee house, a good friend comes in and says, "Well, I just got back from the Boundary Waters. And let me tell you what happened." you know, a branch fell and somebody got hurt and they bound it together. A person starting to tell you this great emotional story, etc., that really changed their life, and you interrupt and say, well, me too. You know, when I was up there a year ago, you know, you cut them off just like that. So real listening is not just listening to the person, but really, you know, checking with them to see, do I listen right? Do I understand right? You know what I mean? And how do I do that? And of course, you don't do Zen listening with everybody. When I'm at the coffee shop, I don't leap across the counter to the person serving coffee and say, oh, how's your day? You know, but think of relatives. We all have relatives, and this is a holiday. Many of us are going to be with relatives, etc. And really listen. I just came back from a funeral a week ago or two. I had a brother-in-law with Lou Gehrig's disease. And so we went to see him, just a horrible disease. I went to see him in June. Just to listen to him, reflecting on his life. When they told him he had this horrible disease, he had 6 months to live. What he said was, what a pity. That's all he said, what a pity. So we all know people like that, you know what I mean? And so practice listening, if you will. And there are lots of barriers and things, and I won't say more about listening except to say just a few about the Me Too is a big one. The impulse to give advice. You know, someone starts talking, we give advice. You know, they want us to listen to them. You know what I mean? And I want, there are wonderful books on the Zen of listening. Just wonderful books on listening, and we should have a course on it. I think we had some practice at one time in the past on it. So I just pass that on, etc. And then before we move on, part of listening is learning to listen to yourself. Learning to listen to yourself. And so we sit there and we watch our breath. And we see the breaths come up and off like bubbles they go, right? But how many of us listen to ourselves? And those are the thoughts that actually come up. And there's a meditation practice called labeling. And I don't know how many people label. But it's a good practice when you start and you're trying to become familiar with the mind. And what you do is a thought comes up and you say, worry. Another thought comes up and you say, planning. Another thought comes up and you say, kids. You know, usually I find I don't want more than four or five categories or something like that. But when we do this in a group, I find that everyone's different. Everyone's life is different. By labeling, you begin to see, you know, what's coming up? What are the patterns? What's coming up? You know what I mean? And so I find that a really good extension of the Zen of listening, and that is to listen carefully to yourself, etc. Well, let me end by talking about five trends in Buddhism in the West, and this is for advanced practitioners, etc. But listen, because I think they're interesting, etc. And the first is intertradition borrowing. And for the very first time in history, within several miles, you have different kinds of Buddhist centers. It's not unusual to go to a Buddhist meeting and have people from other traditions. Theravada, for example, Tibetan, there are various kinds of Mahayana Buddhism. And if you don't know what those terms mean, it doesn't make much difference. But the idea is that they each have somewhat different practices, etc., that have evolved over thousands of years. And so we find today that people are borrowing those practices. And many of them, between traditions, and many of them are wonderful. I brought just a few books. If you don't know Pema Chodron, she's just wonderful. She's a Tibetan Buddhist up in Newfoundland, and she has all kinds. If you go to a place that has Buddhist books, she has a whole shelf. Lots of CDs and things like this. And she does it very much for immeasurables, compassion, loving kindness. And I'm going to say something about that later. So here's an example of kind of a loving kindness, compassion kind of practice, etc., that some people would find. And we find basically that in Buddhism we're starting to do that. We talk about, in our branch of Buddhism, we talk about the four immeasurables and we start doing the compassion and loving kindness. Another practice I really like, and this is Sharon Salzberg's book called The Force of Kindness. And she said, and there's a little CD at the back, she says, if you have no other practice, practice kindness. Practice kindness. And then she goes through chapter after chapter getting really simple as well. Now, Karen Salzberg's in the Theravadan tradition, etc. We're in a Zen tradition. I might mention just one book in our tradition, and this is Thich Nhat Hanh's book, The Heart of Buddhist Teaching, which, again, I find very, very wonderful, etc. So there are lots of books in different traditions, etc. What's the problem? And the problem, of course, is are you diluting your tradition by borrowing? And you'll find in Buddhism, in our own center, you'll find people who are much more traditional and people who are much more open. And it's an issue that's there and has to be kind of resolved, etc. And how do you resolve it? So it's something to think about. And I know people who say, this is the way my teacher did it. And if I don't do it the way my teacher did it, then I'm not doing it properly. And if I don't do it properly, how can I teach students? Okay, how can I teach students? You know what I mean? So you can see, so that's one problem that we all have to work with. Another is democratization. And that is the old Buddhist monasteries in Asia, etc., were patriarchal but very dominated by whoever was in charge. And in the West, etc., we have a board of directors, we have a president of the board, we have an abbot who has 4 or 5 year terms, you know what I mean? Things like that. How is that changing the nature of Buddhism? You're changing the very flow of power, if you will, throughout a center, etc. So how's that impacting the West? In some places like the San Francisco Zen Center, you might have co-abbots. You know what I mean? They might have terms and they step down in their head teachers. And there's a reason for a lot of this that relates to great financial and sexual abuses in the 1980s. A third big trend, and one I've been very interested in, is the feminization of Western Buddhism. And that's not my expression, you know, that's other people's expression. And that is, unlike Asia, traditional, and it's changing, by the way, etc., that women were not equal to men, etc. It was a problem. We find that in the West, as far as I'm concerned, in my own mind, I mean, there is no difference. So what's the issue? What's going on? And one is that basically you find women are introducing, from my perspective, etc., more ideas of compassion and gentleness, etc., into the practice. And if you look at the Asia, you look at the monasteries, and you look at Dogen, etc., you look at the regimented life of the males, etc., that's a different kind of practice, etc. So one thing we want to look into is how that change in the balance of the genders, etc., is affecting our practice. And I think it's an important one. And then a fourth one, just two more to go. A fourth one is integration. And what we mean by integration is the spread of Buddhist practices into other parts of American and Western life in general. This book we read by Siegel, it's a great idea about there's not a single major university medical complex that does not have a mindful spiritual component today. And so medicine is just taking mindfulness in, etc. There's a program, if you go on the web, called Inner Kids. Inner Kids. And that is, how do you introduce mindfulness training, cultivating attention, letting the attunement of the brain occur, etc., getting kids to reflect about their thoughts are their thoughts and they're not their thoughts. How do you do that, etc., with little kids, etc.? You know what I mean? And so it's just beginning. It's just beginning. But there's the Garrison Project. There are all kinds of projects now. And I could go on about how meditation is being taken up, our form of meditation, etc., and other religions, etc. And then the last one I'll mention is just the filtering or change of Buddhism as it enters the West in our practice, etc. You don't hear many people here talk about reincarnation. You find some people who talk about karma. You know, not too many, some, etc. I had a friend in one of my classes last spring who said her sister and her husband were in New York and went to hear some famous Tibetan Lama talk. And the guy says at the beginning, if you don't believe in reincarnation, you cannot be a Buddhist. And they were out of there like that. Just like that. You know, etc. You know, we don't have the behavioral kinds of structure, you know, that you found in Asia, at least in the monasteries, etc. You find also a turning away by people with deep practices from ritual. And I won't say a lot about ritual, but ritual, if you think about how you change the brain by changing the way you think, you change the way, but your brain by the way you act. And if you're an athlete, etc., they talk about visualization. Your brain doesn't distinguish you from going really fast from you to sit there and thinking about going really fast. And so you get these this restructuring of the architecture of the brain, etc., if you will. And so we have, basically all of that, if you will. Those four, and so the question again, as we filter these things out and we develop a unique form of Zen here, etc., are we being true to the tradition? Or are we adapting the tradition to be more useful to Western practitioners for things like this? And so I'm not answering those things, but just saying that these are some of the big things we have basically that we have to think about. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there and just open it up for any comments you might have.
Guy,
and these are the comments.
I have a question.
Oh, question. Okay.
What is the biggest difference between Tibetan and Zen?
Well, there are a lot of differences. One thing that happened is Buddhism spread throughout Asia. And it spreads out in India. Mm-hmm. You know, it spreads across the Silk Road, into China and then into Japan, and then it spreads from India up into Tibet, etc. Is that it's taking on the peculiarities of its local indigenous religions, and many of these were based on. I'm going to answer your question. Many of these are based upon shamanistic religions, and they're very, they're all kinds of spirits and imps and things like this, etc. And you find that Tibetan Buddhism has, very much, comes out of that kind of tradition, that is their local religious tradition, etc. Another difference is if you go into a 3-year training program in Tibet, and you learn literally hundreds of methods of meditation. And I mean, one thing the Buddha said was, people are different. People are different. And so you need different practices for different people. In Zen, on the other hand, if we follow Dogen, etc., that we have a pretty prescribed set of meditations. So I work with a Tibetan teacher in Los Angeles, for example, we learn lots and lots. In Zen, our primary practice, a mature meditator? And mature may mean age in this case, but anyway, may mean age, etc. You find you're doing shikantaza where there's no purpose. And it's called just sitting. There's no purpose. You know, you're getting nowhere. You're changing nothing. But we know from Siegel, of course, that just by holding attention, etc., you're changing yourself. If you're a Tibetan, etc., you're hell-bent on excavating out those bad habits. And so the book we work with is called Wake Up to Your Life. And the first thing you do you kind of look at what's arising, etc. What are these bad habits? And take mindful listening, for example. And one thing you want to do is, if you can, and it's awful hard, is to watch your patterns of listening and see how rotten they are. Really, you know what I mean? And so in Tibetan, you know, they really work on that and work on that and work on that. And the image I often use and is, and somebody in our course added something to it this summer, I usually use the idea of starting a garden. And so you built a house and you want a nice flower garden next to it, okay? And so in Tibetan they would say that, you know, what you got to do is, you know, you got to prepare the soil, you got to get rid of the rocks, you got to pull the weeds out, you know, you got to plant the seeds, you know what I mean? And so there's a whole conscious effort of doing all those things. And what was added this summer by one of our classmates, et cetera, was that even when the roses come up, they have to be deadheaded. And that's wonderful because you have joy, you know what I mean? And you have pride. You know, all these things, you know, they have to be deadheaded because, you know, you've let that take over your practice. And so I found, this is my experience, you know, I found that Tibetan Buddhism to be a much more active. There are other differences too, and this will be the last example. And Zen is what I call a cool Buddhism. Cool Buddhism, excuse me. Black mats. When we walk between meditation periods, we do kin and we walk very slowly. And if you go into a Tibetan temple, a riot of colors. A riot of colors. Everybody walks all over the place. You know what I mean? And so that's just... let me say, one of the problems, if you say, well, I'm going to really get into this, I'm pretty... you know, I really want to learn about all of this. So you go to a bookstore, and you see all these books, and just think of the ones I have here. You know, here's... this is Pema Chodron, Comfortable with Uncertainty. Sharon Salzberg, The Force of Kindness. Or here's Thich Nhat Hanh, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. And these three books are great examples. Each comes out of a different tradition. So you pick up these books, and there's all kinds of different traditions, right? I mean, they're telling you all kinds of different things, and it can be very confusing. And so I'm going to leave you with confusion. But except to say that it's very important to actually get some... I hate to say this, and I may never do it. I started a little book called Western Buddhism, A Gentle Diet for the Puzzle, just to set some of these things clear a little bit. You know what I mean? Somebody else, Susan, you had something?
Oh, yeah. It seemed like you were going to talk a little bit more about how ritual practices and devotional practices can also contribute to rewiring the brain, but you kind of stopped.
Well, I stopped at everything. You know, this is, I'm leaping from the top of one elk to the other, etc. Again, remember, just as by holding attention, you can change the structure of your brain. You know what I mean? By watching the way you move and doing it in certain ways with real intent, no, not just mechanical, but real intent, etc., can do the same thing. So what do? We step into the room when we come to meditate, etc., and we make a little gassho like this. We bow to the altar. We look in the altar, and what do we see? Well, we see flowers, and what do flowers represent? Impermanence. They're beautiful today, and in 2 days they're out in the composting, right? And that's important. So when you walk in, you want to know, you know what I mean? And you're not just bowing to go into the room mechanically, etc., but you're looking, and there's, you know, there's impermanence. You know, the guy sitting here, or guy, girl, you know, they're all kind of mixed up a little bit, except there's Manjushri. And Manjushri is going to help you in your enlightenment practice by slicing through delusion, etc. And so when I walk in, I just look, and then you see prajna or wisdom in the candle, etc. You know what I mean? And so you look in with a purpose, and you know, that is such a heartfelt thing when you bow. And then you walk along the edge towards your mat, and when you bow to your mat, you're not just bowing mechanically, but you're bowing to everybody who's ever sat in a mat for 2,500 years. It's a wonderful vision. Just wonderful vision. Body bow. And you have to feel it, you know. And then you turn around and you bow to the outer room and you're bowing to everybody there who's meditating, who's helping you practice. You know what I mean? And then when you do kinhin, walking kinhin, it's the same thing. And so these are all forms of ritual, etc., that basically we could use. Now, I might want to say that ritual in our center and many centers basically is very under discussed, if I can put it that way. I don't want to say underdeveloped. We don't know what to do with it. You know what I mean? If you're in a monastery, and you're there every day for year after year after year, Dogen, I mentioned Dogen, he had prescribed behavior for everything. You know, the way you walk, the way you ate, on and on and on. You know what I mean? Well, we can't do that. And so this is another of these questions that we have to think about. But think of the intent of it, etc. And then, of course, I might mention we talked about Tibetan Buddhism, and that is that Tibetan Buddhism actually starts with devotional practice. They start with devotion to their teacher as a way to break down ego structure. Okay. Well, I've talked for 45 minutes, and we have more. I had some other questions that I was going to ask, because sometimes I say, any questions, everyone sits there and says, where are the donuts? where are the donuts, And so I'm just going to mention them, and we're not going to discuss them. But one is, what are opportunities for developing these practices? Dan's going to tell us about some in a minute. You want to know about the opportunities. The second was, do I have to become a Buddhist to practice? And the third is, how do I find and work with a teacher, etc.? Well, I'll just mention those. Thank you very much.